This is Faith Matters on 89.1, Lubbock's Voice of the Arts. Join us for a conversation about faith in everyday life, the trials, the tribulations, and the triumphs. Discussions about how faith matters to you and our community. Only on 89.1, Lubbock's Voice of the Arts. Support for Faith Matters is brought to you by Covenant Health, where faith meets the future of medicine. Now, here are your hosts, Ryan Price and David Cruz.
Welcome to Faith Matters. I'm Ryan Price, along with David Cruz. And today in the studio, we have with us Dr. Carlos Hill, who is assistant professor of history at Texas Tech University and also specializes in African-American history, U.S. history, and the history of lynching. And David, you and I have talked for some time now about the possibility of having Dr. Hill on our show, and I think it comes at a particularly important time in the life of our own history here at the end of the summer of 2013, when we've had so much of race in the news, both with the whole Paula Deen episode early on in the summer, and then later on the George Zimmerman verdict. Things that have been underscored for me over and over again throughout the summer is the way in which we continue to be divided by along racial lines.
Thanks, Ryan. Now, that's an excellent introduction, and I'm, like you, very excited to have Dr. Hill with us. I think he's going to be very insightful for our listeners, and I couldn't agree more. Now, one might wonder, well, how is the issue of civil rights or race relations or the way that even we discuss race, how is it a matter of faith? But listen, I couldn't imagine anything more central to faith than this, because although in, say, for example, my congregation, it may not be a pressing issue, it is in a lot of congregations, particularly in the African-American community. And then it's a no-brainer to see how in the African-American churches, it's the religious leaders that really take on these hard issues. And whether it is in the history of our own country, someone like Dr. Martin Luther King, who was a minister, or Malcolm X, who was a religious leader, up to the present day, Al Sharpton, Reverend Jesse Jackson, religious leaders. And so you see that fusion of faith and civil rights coming together. So, Dr. Hill, that's kind of setting the table. Your thoughts as to why this is so important for us to discuss.
Race as a religious, sort of religious issue in a religious context. I might maybe go a step further and say it's race is a moral issue. Racial justice is a moral issue, whether we're talking about the Trayvon Martin case, whether we're talking about mass incarceration, whether we're talking about high rates of unemployment in the African-American community and Hispanic community. It's a moral issue. It's about what is just, right? Our incarceration rates for African-Americans that are probably 5 to 6, 7 times that of whites, is that moral? Is that right? Is that just, right? And so I think framing it not just as a religious issue but a moral issue is where I would sort of, how I would frame it.
As Ryan was saying, the death of this young man whose life ended so abruptly, so suddenly, and so tragically, it sure seems to have polarized our nation.
Yeah.
Tell us about your feelings around the verdict and just your observations.
You know, when I heard the verdict, I was somewhat surprised. I know some in the African-American community, particularly the pundits, were not surprised. But I was somewhat surprised given the media coverage over the last 6 to 8 months. It didn't seem like the media had sided with Trayvon Martin and his family. And it seemed to sort of a casual observer that, you know, a jury of 12 would have also came to the conclusion that he probably shouldn't have. He was shot for the wrong reasons. So when the verdict came down, I was very shocked. And I actually felt very empty for several days. And actually, as an African-American male, vulnerable in a lot of ways. Because, you know, just by walking down the sidewalk, you could be seen as suspicious, and then violence could be used to subdue you. And so I think that's essentially what happened in the Trayvon Martin case. But in speaking in terms of it as a moral issue, a moral crisis, I think the biggest problem with the Trayvon Martin case is not necessarily that George Zimmerman was found not guilty is that we still don't know what really happened that night. We still don't know why George Zimmerman shot Trayvon Martin, in part because the prosecution did not ferret it out, and also in part because the defense made it their business to keep what happened shrouded, right? To keep that opaque so that they could create reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury. And so the biggest travesty of all of this is the fact that we still don't know what happened to Trayvon Martin. And the only two people that really do know is Trayvon Martin, who's not with us, and George Zimmerman. And George Zimmerman did not take the stand. And I think, speaking of morality, he didn't have a constitutional obligation to take the stand. Of course, he had his Fifth Amendment rights. But I think he owed the family of Trayvon Martin and actually the nation as a whole to explain, you know, why did he shoot this 17-year-old kid, right? Why was using lethal force necessary?
And that raises up the point that I've heard over and over again, especially from my black friends and family, who say the whole system and law of stand your ground is unjust in a situation like the Trayvon Martin situation, where the person, the only other person who's involved, is dead and can't speak. Mm-hmm. And so I hear from the black community saying the whole law is unjust. And then yet I hear a lot of white folks, especially on Facebook that I see, people who I would say are considered my Facebook friends, mm-hmm. who say, well, this is the law. The law is the law. And let's just move on.
Well, on the face of the law, it's race neutral, but in terms of how it gets applied, oftentimes African Americans are the target or the victims of the stand your ground. And so the law in and of itself doesn't necessarily target African Americans. It's not, you know, but when we have cases such as the Trayvon Martin, we see how the verdicts come down, right? George Zimmerman had every right, according to the jury, to use lethal force to subdue what they presumed was Trayvon Martin attacking George Zimmerman. And so we never understood quite why, or the defense tried to make the case that Trayvon Martin was a hoodlum, that he was a gangster, and that he was violence prone. And that helped to paint him in a way that would create reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury that more than likely, given who this young man was, his background, he probably did attack George Zimmerman. That's how George Zimmerman got those bruises and scratches across his head, on his back. It was because of this violent youth, right? And so Trayvon Martin may have been standing his ground, but because of his race, I would presume. I don't know what was in the minds of the jury, but I do know how the defense portrayed him. And so
Zimmerman, you mean?
Trayvon Martin. Because Trayvon Martin was actually on trial. It wasn't, I don't think, George Zimmerman was on trial for going to jail, but I think they made a case out of who Trayvon Martin was, and to create
the de facto person being tried was
Trayvon Martin.
Ryan, I know we're about to go on a break, but when we come back, I'd like to ask Professor Hill to speak from his own experience about the issue of profiling, because this is something that came up repeatedly throughout the course of that whole drama when it played out, and I'd like to ask you about that, but also help us to understand why this is such an important issue.
Stay tuned. You're listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts.
You're listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts with your hosts Ryan Price and David Cruz. Brought to you by Covenant Health, where faith meets the future of medicine.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. I'm Ryan Price along with David Cruz, and we are sitting in the studio today with Dr. Carlos Hill, who is assistant professor of history at Texas Tech and specializes in African-American history, U.S. history, and the history of lynching. And before the break, David, we were discussing with Dr. Hill the Trayvon Martin case and the George Zimmerman verdict, and you raised the question about profiling, and I think you have a question for Dr. Hill.
Yeah, it interested me after the verdict was announced a few days afterward that President Obama gave some comments, some remarks, and he talked about in the African-American experience the issue of particularly a young African-American male, what their experience is like when they're profiled. Now, I don't recall, Professor, you might recall, if he used the expression profiling, but his point was how when one is singled out because of the color of their skin, whether it's when they go into a store and they're followed by the clerk, or when they're walking across the street and someone locks the doors of their car or vehicle because they automatically, their fear is increased that that person might be have a greater potential to perpetrate a crime against them. Help us kind of enter in to what is the African American experience when it comes to this, and help those of us who are not a part of that experience and culture to understand.
That's a heavy task, but I can speak more clearly from the vantage point of today rather than, say, in the era of Jim Crow, era of slavery, because there's so many things around surveillance happening today. But to put it in a nutshell, when we talk about profiling, what we're talking about is racist treatment, and that racist treatment really revolves around presuming someone of color, particularly Hispanics and African Americans, are criminals. De facto, as you said, or by default, as you said. And so that's the crux of the issue, right? And so in New York City, over the last, I think, 6 years, there have been 8 million stop and frisk incidents. And over 90% of those, about 90% of those, have been African American and Latino men. And so it's not just stopping those men, right? It's subjecting them to humiliating searches, right, frisking them. I mean, so it becomes an issue of humiliation, feeling degraded, and feeling less than another citizen, right, with the same rights. And so in a nutshell, I think that's the crux of the issue with profiling. Of course, profiling goes back way into the Jim Crow period and of the 1890s all the way to the 1960s. But it also stretches back into the era of slavery. But I think in the modern form, we're seeing it in terms of stand your ground, in terms of stop and frisk in America.
Now, here's kind of, it's not an opposing point of view, but it's just to kind of have another way of looking at this. Don't we all profile? Like, I know I do it, I confess that I do it when I see somebody that has, let's say, an appearance where they have tattoos all over their arms, or maybe they have long hair, or maybe they look disheveled. I automatically presume things about that person that I wouldn't presume about a person that is more appropriate or well dressed in an attire that is maybe a business attire. So don't we all, to some degree, it's just human nature.
Well, I would say You may be right that we all have preconceived notions about how one, if someone dresses in sort of urban attire, who has tattoos, that says something about who they are and what they're capable of, versus someone who has on a business suit, who looks professional, who gets into a Mercedes-Benz. We have different narratives in our heads about who those people are and what they're capable of in terms of our physical person, our physical safety. But I would say that there's a difference between individuals having prejudice and preconceived notions and acting on them, and states, municipalities, governments having preconceived notions about people and acting on them. And so what I mean by that, the state, in terms of New York State, New York City, having a stop and frisk ordinance that actively profiles Latino and African American men. I think that's a big difference. That's a big leap. And so I'm not willing to say those things are one and the same.
Although one might argue that African Americans too, and I say this very respectfully, would also be guilty of profiling and sometimes having those same kinds of preconceived notions, right?
Well, I would say profiling, in the way I'm using it, is institutional. It refers to how municipalities, how governments surveil the population, right? And I'm not, and so if we talk about individuals and their preconceived notions and how they act upon them, whether they clench their purse when they see an African-American male coming with tattoos or with dreads, that's something different to me. And it may be completely reasonable for that person to clench his or her wallet, purse, in seeing that person, right? But I think it's different when a government profiles its citizens with a racist intention, right? Kelly, the police chief Kelly of New York, has said explicitly that the goal of stop and frisk is to terrorize African American and Latino youth, to terrorize them, right? And so the real point behind stop and frisk, and
he said explicitly, African American and Latino youth.
Yes. This is not a direct, I should back up, this is not a direct quote, but the paraphrasing him, he said this is meant to terrorize. This is meant to create fear, right? That if you commit a crime, you will be caught, we will find you. Mm. And so this is the logic of the profiling, right? And so I think it's different than you or I having a preconceived notion, clenching our purse, and the state saying, you know, we are stopping and frisking you. We are allowing others to stand their ground to protect themselves from people like you. I think that's very different.
Along these lines, in the first segment, you mentioned something that I wanted to come back to, mass incarceration, which Michelle Alexander has written a book, and she calls it the new Jim Crow. Implicit in that is the understanding that in some way in this era, quote unquote, of color blindness, there are certain laws, maybe within the criminal justice, which certain people, including Michelle Alexander and a lot of black leaders, really feel like are unjustly and disproportionately affecting communities of color, especially the black community.
Absolutely. I mean, her book is really revolves around the drug laws and sort of the disparity in how African Americans who are found with possession of crack cocaine get much longer sentences, much longer mandatory sentences than typically a white defendant who has just powder cocaine. They will get a lesser minimum sentence. And so her book is about how the drug laws have fed into the mass incarceration system and how the racial disparity and how the law is operated, how it's actually transacted, creates a society in which you have almost a million African Americans behind bars. So yes, her book is all about sort of talking about mass incarceration and the racist underpinnings of that.
When we come back, I want to follow up on that with a discussion between the understanding of the kind of injustice that exists in systemic laws and culture versus what some call personal responsibility. Absolutely. And I would like to have a little bit of some conversation around that. You're listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts.
This is Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts, hosted by Ryan Price and David Cruz, and brought to you by Covenant Health, where faith meets the future of medicine.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. We are sitting here today with Dr. Carlos Hill, who is Assistant Professor of History at Texas Tech, and also specializes in African American history, U.S. history, and the history of lynching. And before the break, Dr. Hill wanted to come back and discuss, just at the beginning of this segment, what Raphael Warnock has called the two wings that make it possible to fly. Of course, Raphael Warnock is the pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, where Dr. King and his father were formerly pastor. But he says it takes two wings in order to fly, and one is the wing of personal responsibility, and then also the wings of equitable public policy. We've been talking a lot about the public policy part, but personal responsibility. And David has something from this week's AJ that I think is a good launching point into that conversation.
Thanks, Ryan. I would love to hear your take on this. It comes from Walter Williams, who is a columnist a syndicated columnist. He is a professor of economics at George Mason University. But he makes the point that each year, roughly 7,000 blacks are murdered in the United States. And he claims that statistics, show that 94% of the time they're murdered by another black person. So he concludes his column by saying, what will a conversation about race relations do about the breakdown of the black family? He says, though breakdown is not the correct word, as the family doesn't form in the first place, particularly he's talking about single parent households in the black community. He says, only black people can solve our problems. Yeah. What's your take on what he's saying?
I mean, it's a very, very complicated issue, but individuals, and I would, even though he's a conservative, I respect Walter. You know, he would never make the point of, he would never bring up, he would never say, you know, whites on average kill, you know, each other, you know, in white on white crimes, you know, it happens 80,000, you know, 80,000 homicides. And this explains the other ills in sort of white society. It's only when it's an African Americans killing African Americans, then it can be linked to other social ills in the black community. And so, I think that's a problem to begin with. But even if we take those numbers to be true, right? Those numbers are accurate. It's a serious problem, right? And Chicago, I think, is the epicenter of sort of black on black homicide, right? Last year, there were over 500 murders in Chicago. 90% of those were African Americans, and most of these are youth. So it's a major problem, the problem that most African Americans on the left have with someone like Walter is that they don't want to talk about then institutional violence that's perpetuated by the police on African Americans. They want to simply talk about personal responsibility and not institutional responsibility, right? And institutional justice. And so, but I would say I don't like to privilege talking about either personal responsibility or institutional responsibility. They both have to be talked about.
It takes two wings to
absolutely,
fly.
Absolutely, as you said.
At the break, we were discussing just the understanding of raising children in what is certainly a racialized climate. I have biracial children. You have a set of twins.
Yes.
I would like to hear a little bit about what you're telling your kids about growing up black, I'm presuming.
Yeah. Yes.
In the United States in the 21st century.
Well, they're only 3 months old now. So I'm not, you know, I'm just singing to them at this point. But I don't know what I will tell them when they come of age. America could be a very different place in 10 years. I know it'll be a very different place in 25 years. So I'm not sure what I would tell them. I would relate to them my anxieties, my paranoia around race, but I would also share with them my experiences, the positive experiences that I've had. But in many ways, I would preach to them what we just talked about, personal responsibility, be accountable for yourself and expect the same from others, right? And so expect to be treated as a human being, expect to be treated right. But if you're not, stand up for yourself, hold others accountable, right? And I think I wouldn't necessarily be teaching them lessons about race and race relations. I would just simply be teaching them how to be a human being in the world, how to be responsible in the world. And if they came to me and they said, I had this racist experience or et cetera, then I would say, well, maybe this is how we should proceed. And so I think for me, particularly because I have biracial children as well, I don't want to overlay on them an identity. Mm-hmm. I want them to come to their own identity. I don't want to foist on them my own anxieties. I want them to discover them if they discover them. And at that point, then try to deal with where they are in the world and try to shape and navigate them.
Ryan, Professor, we began the conversation today by posing this question, why is this an issue related to faith? And it occurred to me that probably the greatest civil rights story that's ever been told is itself in the Bible, in the book of Exodus. Mm-hmm. Ryan, you know the story well, the story of the slavery and captivity of the Israelites when God sent Moses to Israel to let his people free and to bring them to the promised land. And I think that story is such a paradigm for our own lives as, mm-hmm. as faith people, regardless of what denomination or what your background is of faith. Because, Ryan, if we make that our paradigm, we're going to want all people, regardless of the color of their skin, regardless of their ethnicity, to know that they're children of God and that everybody has dignity and should be treated as such.
Yeah, one of the things I really love about that story is the fact that not only were the Israelites enslaved, but the truth of the matter, Pharaoh and the Egyptians were enslaved in a master mentality as well. And places where we've seen real freedom come about, like South Africa, Desmond Tutu's leadership there, Mandela's leadership, have underscored the fact that this is a faith matter, and God is concerned about the deliverance of people, all peoples, oppressor and oppressed. And that is one of the fundamental elements of the Hebrew and Christian scriptures.
Can I say, too, to the professor, I loved his answer, by the way, about the column of Walter Williams. Can I say, too, that a lot of the social ills in the Hispanic community, and I can speak to that, I believe, at least to some degree, because I am the son of Mexican immigrants and have lived all my life in Texas. But I really believe this, that a lot of the social ills in our community are also issues of personal responsibility, and that very often crime perpetrated against Hispanics is by Hispanics. So it's an equal challenge to the Hispanic community, exactly what you said.
Yeah, I mean, I think when African Americans get riled up about conservatives who make this point, the point that I made earlier, they would never talk about white-on-white homicides and that being linked to necessarily Columbine or to Sandy Hook, as a deep systemic problem in white America. It'll be individualized to those particular individuals, not to the race as a whole. And so that's the problem, right, is that there different rules seem to apply for African Americans to Latinos than it does to the mainstream society.
Dr. Hill, we're coming up at the end of the show. August 28th will mark the 50th anniversary, the March on Washington. Absolutely. What has changed and what has stayed the same after 50 years in America?
Well, a lot has changed, African-American president, but we still have racial injustice, as evidenced by Katrina, as evidenced by lately Trayvon Martin and mass incarceration. And so a lot has changed, but it's what Amilcar Cabral calls the changing same. Things have changed, but in many fundamental ways, they've stayed the same. African Americans are still on the bottom of U.S. society. They were on the bottom of U.S. society in 1900, 1950, and still today in every significant socioeconomic category. And so you have an African American president, but the masses of African Americans still find themselves in poverty, many of them in prison, and many of them, I would say, in places like Chicago, Detroit, Newark, feeling hopeless, that they have any possibility of changing their future. And so I would say there is progress in a lot of key areas, right? You have LeBron James of the world, you have Oprah's, you have very visible success stories in the African American community that have been made possible by a Civil Rights Act of 1965. But in many ways that wasn't enough to lift everyone up.
We've come a long way, but we got to keep marching.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Faith Matters with Carlos Hill. You can catch this program and all other Faith Matters programs on our website at kttz.org. You've been listening to Faith Matters on 89.1 Lubbock's Voice of the Arts.